you know, half the stuff that comes out of my mouth sometimes, I'm genuinely confused. Like, I can talk some proper shit. Hello, everybody. Welcome to The Next Stage. I'm Toby Vince, and I will be your host for this episode. Today, I'm joined by Lily Constance. She is one quarter of the theatre company Not Blood Sisters. They are going to be performing Call Me Suicidal at this year's Edinburgh Fringe. It's a piece of dark comedy that, as the title implies, it follows the topic of suicide, which, you know, it's a very taboo topic. It's something we all need to talk about a bit more. And this play does a really, really good job at it. Take a listen. Hello, everybody. Welcome to The Next Stage. Today, I'm joined by Lily, one part of theatre company Not Blood Sisters. Hi, Lily.
Hello. How are you, Toby?
I'm very good. How are you doing today?
Doing great, thank you.
Good, good. Thank you for taking some time out of your day to come and have a chat with us. I know you've got a very busy schedule on with the show.
Yes, we just finished three shows at Riverside Studios this past week as part of their Bite Size Festival.
Leads us well into my first question, as it goes. So, you know, this is a question we've been asking all of our companies and artists this season. What we would like to know is, what does Fringe Theatre mean to you?
Yeah, I love this question because when I was living in New York City, I don't think I'd ever heard of Fringe Theatre, except probably in the context of Edinburgh Fringe Festival. And I studied a year at Oxford when I was an undergrad. So I was able to spend some time in London. I found London to be much more interesting than Oxford, you know, especially in terms of the theatre scene. I might get a little bit of flack from Oxford theatre people, but I think that... actually, one of the main reasons that I moved to London was for the Fringe Theatre scene. And I think, to me, Fringe Theatre is financially accessible theatre. You know, we're all seeing the prices of tickets on the West End these days and on Broadway as well. And to me, Fringe Theatre means that anyone can come and see it. So it's art that's actually for the people and all people. And I think that it's also a platform for new writing. I feel like the literal just amount of smaller theaters in London is a testament to, I think, just a greater appreciation for new voices. You know, that was something that I really wasn't seeing in New York is, opportunities, you know, to not only, you know, write new work, but have it staged and actually have people come. You know, Not Blood Sisters is such a new company, but the fact that a theater like Riverside, you know, which is honestly a stunning venue and puts on such professional theater, also puts in that time and money to give voice to new writing is just so exciting. I also think, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people would agree that Fringe Theater is a space where you can push the boundaries a little bit more, you know? Our kind of Not Blood Sisters tagline is, woman writing the stories you're too afraid to tell. And I think, you know, we approach writing this script with a bit of apprehensive, you know, that thought process of not wanting to offend anyone, but I think we felt like we were in almost really safe hands with kind of the Fringe Theatre scene in London.
Oh, yeah. And I completely get what you mean about how you approach writing stuff without being offensive. Like, we'll talk a bit more about the play in a second. But I think what Fringe Theatre offers, as you say, it offers opportunity. It offers a chance to sort of grow organically. You know, a lot, in a comedy sense at least, a lot of the most well-known comedians in the UK, like the ones who are doing stand-up or who are on telly, they're the ones who've honestly started out at Fringe Theatre, but up in Edinburgh. Even some now, you know, when I was looking through the programme, there were some big names now who are there, who, are, you know, are still doing it because Fringe is almost... it's almost non-negotiable in the theatre world, I would say. You've sort of got to do it, not because it's like a prerequisite to be a theatre maker, but more so the amount of opportunity it provides and the amount of people that simply will pass through, like fringe venues such as, in your case just now, Riverside, or in future Edinburgh. It's too good an opportunity to pass up, you know?
Yeah, and I think it seems like there's this mutual investment in fringe theatre also from the people who have made it, you know, not only actors who have pretty big platforms, but I feel like the playwrights that are doing really well will still, you know, go back to fringe. And I had the opportunity recently to do a writing retreat with Ryan Callie Cameron, who wrote for Black Boys Who Considered Suicide When the Hue Gets Too Heavy. It was on the Royal Court, then transferred to West End. And he was saying, oh yeah, we're going up to Fringe for like the first week. And I was like, oh, see you there. You know, it's just, I think a pretty, nothing really matches it.
So what you are bringing to the Fringe, it's a new piece of work. It's called Call Me Suicidal. Tell us a little bit about it. Give us some insight into the early stages of the show. You know, what pursued you to follow the idea?
This idea really came from a place of what the four members of Not Blood Sisters could write as a group of four. We... along the process had a lot of feedback from people saying, why are you writing a play with four people? I think it's a little bit unheard of, and we've learned potentially very difficult to, you know, kind of get one voice from four people. But initially, so I think also, you know, just to give you context that I'm from the States, and then my three other co-founders are from Ireland, India, and the UAE. So we represent, you know, pretty diverse backgrounds and experiences. I actually have a background in journalism, and then we also have backgrounds in acting, directing, and engineering and advertising. So it kind of seemed like the world was our oyster as far as, you know, what we would choose to co-write. And initially, we tried writing a play where each of us was writing a character that was essentially ourselves, and we were four adopted sisters. but we realized that we definitely were going with what just seemed to be the easiest plot for the four of us as people to write. So then we had a chat about what are topics that are important to us as a group that we each maybe have kind of equal investment or interest in. And we started talking about suicide, and I think specifically the female experience of mental illness and suicide. And you know, we were having a chat about, I think it's interesting that, you know, while there are very high rates of suicide in men, a lot of women report being just as suicidal, but that they just don't have the time to actually really follow that path, and that they have too many people relying on them. And, you know, so this already is a pretty fraught subject area. But I think the second we started talking about it and realized also how uncomfortable it was to really acknowledge these different truths, we were like, well, this is a great kind of instigatory topic to dive into for a play.
It goes back to what you were saying a bit earlier about making sure that you're writing stuff sensitively, but also not being afraid to like explore the uncomfortable, you know. That, in my opinion, part of theatre's point is about being able to talk about and explore things that you wouldn't do in reality, because especially of disbelief is a massive thing in theatre just generally, I think that does give it license to talk into a few, into some more in-depth topics, which in this case you've landed upon suicide, especially in women. And, you know, it's, you know, I mean, I'm just speaking from the perspective as a, of a man here, you know, obviously I can't completely understand and relate to, you know, the female experience because I'm not a woman. From how I view it, it's so interesting to me how you say that from your research, women don't feel like the time to explore that path. It's really profound, and I think it adds like so much more of a layer to it, because it almost sounds as if, honestly, you feel selfish for feeling bad, you know?
Yeah, I think that that's a completely accurate observation, and it was something that really resonated with the four of us.
What you've done, though, with this is, I mean, suicide, it's a very serious topic, and I think that in order to tackle it without, honestly, without making your audiences feel drained, you've gone down the route of dark comedy. And I was thinking about this, there's a lot of dark comedy that's happening nowadays, and I think that that's probably a reflection of the wider world, isn't it? However, as a genre, it really does provide you as a writer and a performer and a producer and whatever, like, it gives you the unique challenge of having to find humour for these subjects that, you know, we can often find troubling or quite macabre, you know? So when you were developing the show, what do you think the key to writing dark comedy effectively was?
I think my answer would be that we're not sure if we did it effectively. And I would love to speak to someone who feels that they did it really effectively. I think it's so interesting because I feel like it also comes so much down to what your audience's reaction is, you know, what the four of us might find funny, someone else might not. I think that where we kind of landed, though, is that, you know, in just discussing our own personal experiences and anecdotes, like, so much of it is just funny. Like, there's a level of absurdism to all of our daily experiences, you know, and if you just try to write accurately about someone's life, the humor is there. Like, I think you don't actually have to try to insert it. There was maybe moments where we tried to insert it, and it was interesting seeing when there was laughs and when there wasn't. So I would say it's definitely still a work in progress for us. I would never have considered myself a comedy writer. I think writing comedy is much more difficult than writing drama.
There was something quite profound someone said to me once, which is, I think it was tragedy plus time equals comedy. And I think this is probably a play that's quite testament to that. You know, if something terrible happened to me in the next half an hour, which, you know, touch wood, it doesn't, I probably would find humour in it maybe a few months down the line, you know? Because once you've settled into it and you've, like, come to peace with that, you're like, how did that happen? You know? And, like, and you're like, you always think back to, like, weird stuff you did as a kid. Like, yeah. There's plenty of bizarre stories that I could probably dig out of the vaults that I won't for now. However, like, What were sort of the inspirations then? Did you was there like certain set material in the past that as a company you were like, oh, we love that style of comedy, let's follow that? Or is it something that you've, you went into the rehearsal space and said, let's just devise and see what we create?
You know, I just want to add that my co-founder, Frances, you know, she had said that in her conversations, because she does write a lot of brilliant comedy, but that in her conversations with people, she's always curious about the moment where you started laughing about the thing that used to be tragic. And that I think it's like that moment and how you got there that a lot of dark comedy that is effectively written can come from. But yeah, I think it was definitely more of a devise, like, let's just get into the space and see what starts to happen. We did look into, you know, some other plays that dealt with suicide, and other two women shows, and how they had kind of been staged with minimal sets. We kind of knew with the time frame and the budget we were working with, that we were going to have some constraints as far as how creative we could get with set and movement. And yeah, so I think that the script was very much sort of an organic thing throughout the whole process, from research to discussion to writing to staging.
And I think that's quite important when it comes to work like this, because, you know, it's good to have reference points in the back of your head, because you could be like, oh, do we go down a comedy route, as in are we going for Charlie Chaplin, are we going for a bit of Blackadder, are we going for the list goes on, but I digress. Like, there's many different ways that you can interpret comedy, and I think that by you as a four getting into the rehearsal space and, like, exploring organically what becomes of the piece, I think that makes it so much more stronger, because it gives you the opportunity to say, no, but this is the Not Blood Sisters thing. We're not trying to be something else. So, as the title implies, suicide, it's a very prevalent theme in the work, and, you know, it's a very polarizing topic to tackle, and it often leads to it not being talked about. You know, as your research showed earlier, you know, some people can find it selfish to consider suicide, which is, like, horrible as a thought, and you don't want it to be, like, a growing thing at all. That shouldn't have to be said. How does the play frame conversations then about suicide whilst maintaining its genre? How do you find that balance between the comedy and the truth?
You know, I think good storytelling shouldn't be prescriptive. We really wanted to avoid making definitive statements about suicide, but rather depict just one individual's experience, you know? I mean, really what Call Me Suicidal is just one woman's conversation with herself. You know, and when all you're left with is kind of the voices in your head, there's no, you know, that only is the truth. I mean, we have the ways in which we lie to ourselves sometimes, but I think that it became very easy, actually, to just let this live, our main character's story, unfold, and without having to actually get into a sort of, like, generalized or intellectual debate or conversation about suicide, because that isn't how we would think about it ourselves. You know, it's just, like, the feelings that we feel. And, you know, we actually don't say the word suicide at all in the play. You know, what the underlying tension is that here is someone who is trying to figure out why she is the way she is. What's the thing? Maybe, like, there's one thing that's happened in her life that's kind of contributed to making her this person. And that kind of question is, okay, what is she going to do, you know, when she reaches a conclusion? Yeah, but I think that it's tricky with topics that are as polarizing as this, because I don't think that, you know, you should sort of say there's one right way to act or that there's one right conclusion. Like, you can only really sort of try to be honest.
You are completely correct in how these sorts of topics are very intrinsic. You know, it's good that you were framing it in a way where it's like, this is not the definitive and only acceptable perception of this topic. This is one person's. Doesn't mean it's yours, doesn't mean it's theirs, doesn't mean it's ours even. This is just one person's. And I think for a lot of audiences, I was having this conversation with I can't remember who else it was on the podcast now, but we were talking about how, as audiences, we don't like to be told how to feel. We like to be given an impression through action, but we don't like someone to physically say, you should be sad, or you should be laughing. It should be a case of, you could make that decision for yourself. And I think, again, that's where this very personable element to this play comes. Listen, we have Lily here. She is one quarter of Not Blood Sisters. We are going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. And we're back. So, Lily, Call Me Suicidal, it's not just fictitious. It's also semi-autobiographical. And I was reading from the notes that you've put in descriptions. You've mentioned that it's a reflection of your own struggles with identity and existence, not just yourself personally, but as a company. So I'd like to ask, what would you say the key is to including personal experience within a narrative in a healthy way is?
Yeah, this is a really important question, I think, for all theater makers and writers in general. Because we jumped into this experience in the midst of our master's program, a lot of stuff going on in all of our lives, and actually probably didn't exercise the discretion that we should have in writing about a topic that was personal to each of us in different ways. So it was actually about like halfway through the process that we had a light bulb moment of, oh, we need to sit and talk about each of our individual relationships to suicide and to mental health and keep that private among the four of us. But we have chosen to write a play as the four of us and understanding the specifics of each of our relationships to it is relevant, you know? And so that, happened, I think, slightly out of order in the way than it should have. And to be totally honest, it really did impact us physically and mentally, especially in the beginning. Like I said, I think we just kind of jumped in feet first, using all of our free time to meet up, write, argue. We had a Google Doc open, with the four of us typing in it. I'm American, I'm loud, I'm impatient, sometimes would, be the first to type something and, someone might not agree with that. At different points, we tried implementing, setting a 1 minute timer. If there's a line that we disagreed on, like, okay, we can debate this for 1 minute. And then we just have to go with majority vote for what the line should be. But then when we reached the point of finishing our first draft, because we had set a pretty specific just timeline, since we knew we were going to be going to Fringe, that, a timeline for where things had to fall. So we finished our first draft, sent it out to some mentors for feedback, and took about 2 weeks off and from each other too. And when we all four came back, we were like, are you really depressed? And like, yeah. Are you really depressed? Like, has anyone been like really struggling and really low? And I went into that being like, oh my God, this is embarrassing. Like, I'm a grown woman. I don't know why I've had like this very random kind of slump. But then everyone felt completely the same way. And that was kind of a huge wake up call of, oh, we're actually not going about this in the healthiest way. And these things happen when you do have kind of time constraints and busy schedules. But I think from that moment, what we learned is that you do need to understand everyone's personal relationship to the topic that you're writing about. And then I think another thing to go about it in a healthy way is just regularly checking in. Like our director, Ashna, at the end of each rehearsal would have us all go around and say, this is something I really liked about today or didn't feel good about. So kind of starting with the positive and then sharing whatever the negative was. And that might have been like, I couldn't let go of my insecurity with saying this one line. Or it might have been, I feel like you're not really hearing me on, you know, this thing. So there needs to be kind of that space for open communication. And then I think understanding everyone's boundaries. The tricky thing with that is, I think ideally trust is involved. So, you know, if you're working with people that maybe you don't know as well, I think you have to work a little bit harder to make sure that trust is also there. And I think it's pretty important to have a discussion about how to maintain separation between personal and professional dynamics. And I mean, this is maybe more specific to our group since we met in the context of friendship. But then we've kind of moved forward with, you know, professional obligations and agreements with one another. So just being on the same page about, you know, how you can make sure to satisfy professional obligations while still maintaining like those personal dynamics.
I mean, speaking from my personal perspective, you know, when I've written and produced work, whatever, I've always been quite adamant about setting time for work, setting time for me, and having that detachment between myself and the work that I create. I think, you know, and you've alluded to this beautifully, I think when we write work, it's inevitable that a part of our personal story is going to be in there, which is why a lot of people, myself included, can get very wrapped up into the writing process, and they can go and go and go and go, and it's not healthy at all, because what you're essentially doing is you're unpacking everything about you into a script. And as tough as it is to say, you also have to think about the integrity of this as a piece of work rather than as a piece, honestly, rather than as a piece of like free writing for you as a person, you know? So I think having those boundaries between what's you personally and what's you professionally can really help with like exploring and creating work in a healthy way.
Yeah, and I think it's so interesting how just creatives and artists in general have to really sit with what that means, because it isn't as relevant in other fields of work, you know, kind of maintaining the separation between the personal and professional, but kind of, you know, the inherent part of creating something is that it's coming from you and often relating, yeah, to your own experience or taste.
Moving on to the characters in the play a bit more, I'd like to have a chat about death. Now, death is, in this case, it's a character. You've took upon the gauntlet of personifying them. And, you know, I absolutely loved it. This, to me, is killer writing. That the pun wasn't intended. So... I love this. It goes, life's a bitch, but so is death. And for me, I absolutely love that. So I'd like to know, in the context of Call Me Suicidal, who is death? And why did you create them the way that you did?
Yeah, I think, you know, death has been personified, obviously, in so many different forms, so many different plays and other stories. So that was a big question for us. It's like, okay, well, what, you know, what makes ours special? What makes ours different? And that did change a lot throughout the process, actually, because I think where we originally started was death really is her own person too, like a real actual divinity or whatever, who has a job. The job can be grueling. She has memories, you know, a set of experiences in life outside of her relationship with Liv. And where we landed was that it wasn't working for it to be both of their stories with, you know, the format that we were writing, which was a one act, you know, about 47 minutes. we decided that it had to be one of their stories. You know, there was one of them was going to be the main character. And for us, it ended up being more natural for that to be Liv. So what that meant for the character of Death was that Death in Call Me Suicidal is Liv's death. It's, you know, kind of, we this is yet another area where we didn't want to be totally prescriptive. Like, I think it also could be up for interpretation. I think what we imagine going into it is that Death is as Liv specifically might imagine her. So for Liv, that's sexy, confident, kind of obnoxious, tattoos, funny, a little crazy out there. But also, you know, I think something we were going for is Death kind of being the voice of reason too. Maybe she's the angel and the devil on the shoulder. And so what a little bit of that meant is sort of like a big sister, little sister vibe too. And I think that what big sister, little sister dynamics often mean is antagonistic and teasing, a little bit bitchy sometimes, you know. And I think why it really worked to go for this angle of Death was that we kind of got away with not having to, you know, have our entire lore for Death and like rules around who Death is, what her powers are, like, because this really is just Death as Liv imagine. And, you know, I think there was part of us too that was thinking of Death as depression or Death as just this presence of quote unquote darkness that, you know, all of us in different ways feel throughout our lives. You know, in the first, Call Me Suicidal is kind of a series of present moments interrupted by flashbacks. And one of the first flashbacks we see is Liv when she's 7 at her cousin's funeral, and Death is there, and it's the first time they're meeting. So just this idea that a child can also feel that darkness, you know, and but that also unpacking a little bit what the darkness really actually is, that maybe there's a bit of a comfort in it. You know, I think that it's easy to maybe get used to the presence too, because it's much more familiar than maybe feeling intense joy, you know. So Death as a presence that isn't frightening.
If I was to be the existential, that, you know, we always say, well, I say we always say, I always think that life's only certainty is death. And it's amazing how one thing is that, well, how as one thing, the one thing that we all know and all have to accept is going to happen to us in the end terrifies us the most. So I think the way that we personify death, especially in this case where, as you said, this is Liv's idea of death as being this very, like, sexy and non-traditional, I imagine, like, hooded death with a giant scythe that's going to come and, like, knock it off, yeah? I think the humour in that will provide people a lot of, I would argue a lot of comfort, to be honest, because it's a very different perception of what death is, you know?
Yeah, and I think, you know, even in our poster art, it's Liv that has a shadow, and the shadow is kind of the hooded figure with the whatever the thing is called, the sword thing. And Death doesn't have a shadow. So, you know, I think we just wanted to play a little bit with actually Liv is the one who's much more, I guess, death-like than we'd think in like the traditional sense, you know?
Do you know, I'm quite curious because, you know, as you've said, you've literally just finished with your runs at Riverside now. Whilst that's fresh in your mind, what do you want to take away from those runs up at Riverside ready for Edinburgh. Is there something that you've learnt from that process? Or is there, or are you like, okay, we've done Riverside, we're really happy with how it went, let's keep up that momentum ready for Edinburgh?
I think we've learned a ton, definitely, from our debut performances. We actually had a feedback form that we shared with the audience, because at this point we do see this as a work in progress that we believe can use some tweaks before we go to Fringe. So it was really helpful just to get that feedback and, you know, see how we have a lot of really quick transitions in our play between kind of memory and present, like I mentioned. In one of those, I accidentally kicked a glass wine bottle, like, up into another realm and made such a loud noise. Luckily, it didn't break. So, you know, it's just little things like kind of smoothing out the blocking and those transitions. And I think it's so interesting with comedy how there actually is going to be audience interaction, you know, as opposed to, I think, drama where people probably aren't going to be regularly laughing, I would hope. I would say all three of the performances at Riverside were very different. The first one being a very full audience who was very responsive, you know, bursting out, laughing, actually audibly sobbing at the end. And as a performer, that's quite exhilarating and, of course, feeds kind of the energy. And then a much less full theater the second night and much more quiet, you know, maybe just like a couple silent chuckles. And so I think, I guess I'm speaking a little bit more from a performing perspective, learning to just deliver consistently, you know, regardless of that response that you're getting. I think also just the chance to hear people's interpretations of some of these moments where as a company we're interpreting it a certain way, and you know, to be able to learn that some people have really different interpretations, I think is very relevant for, you know, the next couple weeks as we kind of revisit our script.
You've touched on like a really good point about audiences. You know, you never know what kind of audience you're going to get with Fringe. That's part of the fun. You could have a packed house or just one person, but either way, the one thing that remains constant is the excellence of the piece that you have to perform, you know? So I think just through those three shows that you did at Riverside, they would have given you a very good like taste of what to expect to come here in Edinburgh. Was Riverside your first experience with the Fringe for this show? Was Riverside your first Fringe?
Yes, it was.
Oh, cool. Now you're in for a good one then, I think, at Edinburgh. I really do. I'm quite curious though. Like, are you going to keep up this idea with the feedback at Edinburgh as well?
Yeah, I think that we are at a stage where will continue to be open to feedback, because, you know, we're all theater makers and we recognize that really good theater comes from multiple drafts and spending a lot of time with a project. I know another one of the plays at Riverside was a product of 6 years of work, which, you know, we cannot claim. I know, I'm like, what? But I think, you know, we don't have any illusions about sort of, you know, how new our work is and just our investment in it being kind of the best story that it can be, I think, involves just being open to feedback.
Lily, listen, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast. It's been great to learn all about the show and Not Blood Sisters and listen to your experiences for The Fringe. I do have to ask you, what is the next stage for Call Me Suicidal and Not Blood Sisters? What can we expect from you during and post the Edinburgh Fringe Festival this year?
Yeah, well, if you see us in Fringe, don't be afraid by the tattoos that are going to be covering my body as I continue on the role of death. But I think that we're pretty eager into exploring a longer run in the London Fringe theme post-Edinburgh. There's just some great small theatres here that offer, you know, 3-week to 4-week runs for newer works. And I think because our play is pretty fit for these smaller spaces, don't have a lot of set demands and stuff like that. I think that's kind of what our next several steps are going to be after August.
Awesome stuff. And where can we find you and the company online, Lily?
So you can follow us on Instagram. That's at Not Blood Sisters. And the two O's are zeros because the other name was taken.
That's always the case, isn't it? I'll make sure to put it all in the episode description so you can find them on Instagram. Seriously, come along to Edinburgh. The show's performing. It's at Greenside Riddles Court Willow Studio. Come along and see the show. It will be great. You've got a fair few dates whilst you're in Edinburgh, so no excuse not to pop up, grab a ticket and go see this really profound and funny show. Lily, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me, Toby. It was a pleasure.
And that was Lily from Not Blood Sisters. Call Me Suicidal. It plays from the 15th to the 19th of August. It's at Greenside's Riddle Court Willow Studio. Shows will begin at 9 p.m. and they last 45 minutes. As you've heard, this is going to be one of those shows that if you want to laugh, if you want to explore those topics that you might feel a bit uncomfortable with in real life, I stress inverted quotations, this is a show for you. I think that this company have really got themselves a winner on their hands. And, you know, as I've said, although it is a work in progress, don't be afraid to go and support it. I still think it's going to be one of those shows that you do not want to miss at this year's Edinburgh Fringe Festival. This episode concludes our series of the Edinburgh Fringe specials. You can go back and listen to all of the episodes available on Spotify and on our website, as well as Apple Music and wherever else you get your podcasts. Thank you so much to all of our guests for coming on and talking with me about their shows. If you are listening and you are an artist and a performer and would like to go on the podcast, please feel free to get in touch with myself and Greta. You can find us on our website at www.thenextstagepod.com. or alternatively, email us at thenextstagepod@gmail.com. All of those links are available in our episode description. Once again, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you at the next stage.